Now, in the tradition of Hanukkah storytelling, I'm not going to tell you one of the stories of Hanukkah as we have it in the Matzor, or as we have in the lights of Hanukkah. I want to tell you a Hanukkah story that goes back to the Hanukkah of 1944. And I'm reading this story from the article in the Jerusalem Post going back nearly 25 years ago, where I first encountered it. And here's the story. And by the way, it fits in very well with the kind of heroes that we have at Hanukkah time and the kind of bravery and stand that was important to take, even if there was a possibility of suffering or a cost that was involved. That Hanukkah of 1944, we had just one small light for 8 days, but it lit a flame in our hearts. Reichenbach is a small town in Silesia, not far from Breslau. This lovely old town had several factories using slave labor, and I was one of a group of 32 women and girls sent from Auschwitz-Birkenau to work at the Telefunken plant in aid of the German war effort. Together with prisoners from Holland, a number of us were to make small electric bulbs for use in aircraft. All the prisoners lived outside the town, in separate camps for men and women. The distance from factory to camp was between 4 and 6 kilometers. But it seems irrelevant to dwell on the distance, since in our debilitated condition, each step cost us enormous effort. Our conditions, both in the camp and at the factory, were actually better than in Birkenau. And the food was better, too. But we had to work 12-hour shifts. And trudging through the woods to and from work, frequently on an empty stomach, in rain, snow, and howling wind, that was no small feat. We walked 5 in a row, helping and dragging each other when needed, leading forward against the wind. On these journeys, I would say my prayers, whatever I could remember by heart, and the women near me would ask me to recite them aloud so that they could hear them as well. Near the outskirts of town, we passed near a bakery which emitted the agonizingly tantalizing aroma of fresh baked bread. The impossible dream of ever eating our fill only seemed to make our hunger worse. As Hanukkah approached and the weather made the journeys harder and harder, I spoke to the girls about planning the lighting of Hanukkah lights. It was something to look forward to. We could relive the Hanukkah festivities we remembered from home and remember that there were other things besides hunger, cold, and weakness. We conspired among ourselves as to who would pilfer what. The women who worked near machinery could steal a few drops of oil each day. But the hardest task was finding something to hold the oil. One girl stole a potato. How can I explain what a delicious meal a raw potato makes when one is so very, very hungry? For a week, we looked at that potato time and again, but no one ate it. What a miracle. Now we had everything except matches. One girl, sent to fetch food from the kitchen, managed to steal a box with a few matchsticks in it. These were girls who had never seen Hanukkah lights, yet they wanted to take part in the lighting, despite the risk of being discovered. We came back from work that first Hanukkah night. After finishing the soup that was our supper, we began our preparations. We made a cavity in the potato and put a few drops of precious oil in it. We pulled some threads from our clothes, twisted them into a wick, and placed it in the oil. We propped up the potato in the window, as tradition demands, for all to see, and made the blessing. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandment and commanded us to light the Hanukkah lights. And blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who performed miracles for our ancestors in those days at this time. We sang Ma'ot Tzur, as we will tomorrow night. And now came our second miracle. No one arrived to beat us up or demand to know where we had gotten all these things. Some 40 prisoners took part in the lighting and the singing that night, and I told the girls that this flame represented freedom and the eternity of the Jewish people. So it was for them, and so it has been for us down through the ages, because of what took place in that first Hanukkah night, nearly 2,100 years ago now. And it's one of the reasons we say, Happy Hanukkah. Or more properly, Hanukkah Sameach. And given that it's Hanukkah, we not only tell stories and sing songs, I want to take a look at Hanukkah then, and as the bulletin reminds you, and then. Well, hold on to that, we'll get to it. Hanukkah then. What's it all about? Or what was it all about? Remembering the story, Hanukkah is related to the events surrounding the desecration and subsequent dedication of the Second Temple in the years usually given to us as 167 to 164 before the Common Era. It celebrates the miraculous victory God enabled the Maccabees and their followers to achieve against overwhelming odds. Their victory ensured purity of the worship of God, and it preserved the God-mandated distinctiveness of Israel and of our unique Jewish identity. The story in brief goes like this, and remember I promised you stories. Briefly, it goes like this. Under the directives of the Syrian ruler Antiochus, often these were called the Greeks, the temple was defiled and it was turned into a heathen shrine. So before it could be properly used again, it had to be cleansed. God granted the Maccabees a tremendous victory over vastly larger Syrian forces time and time again. And as a result, they recaptured Jerusalem. And so the Jewish people back then were able to cleanse and rededicate the temple. Therefore, Hanukkah, which comes from the Hebrew word for dedication, Hanukkah originated as the festival of the dedication or cleansing of the temple. And then the story goes on. It continues to tell us of the lack of sufficient oil to rekindle the temple menorah. In fact, only enough oil was found to keep the menorah lit for one day. However, as we all understand, it takes 7 days to properly prepare appropriate oil to light the temple menorah. So another miracle occurred. The one day's worth of oil kept that menorah lit for 8 days until the new oil was finally ready. As a result, the festival was celebrated thereafter for 8 days. Light and the kindling of the light, one for each of the 8 days that the oil miraculously lasted, lights became the central feature of this celebration. And that's the basics of the story. So we know what the Maccabees fought for and against, at least at the very basic level. But there was an even deeper, more profound struggle that they were involved in, let me suggest. And I want to focus on that for just a bit, because it had to do with Hellenism and the Greek worldview. So what was it about the Greek perspective that was so untenable to the Jewish people? The answer is reasonably clear. The Greeks stood, and remember, as I mentioned, the Syrians were called Greeks as well, because they were the descendants of the empire of Alexander the Great. Anyhow, the Greeks, in the broader sense, stood for the supremacy of the human. Statues, sports, philosophy. Greece dominated the world, and their worldview was reflected in every field of human accomplishment, whether it's art or literature or music or science, medicine or philosophy or architecture. You see, Aristotle and Plato changed the philosophical landscape, and by doing so, shaped the whole of Western civilization. The Jew, however, stands for the supremacy of God, not of the human. Our greatness is in viewing ourselves in terms of a higher moral authority, something greater than our own mental consciousness or our own moral conscience. For the Jew, the human being is created in the image of God. For the Greek, God is created in the likeness of the human being. The Greek gods are superwomen and supermen who can eat, drink, and indulge in everything to superhuman excess. Therefore, Greek oppression of the Jews was nothing less than a war between these two worldviews. The Greeks simply were determined to assert cultural dominance throughout that part of the world. And their tactic? Well, their tactic was this. Outlaw key elements of Jewish observance. the five specific areas which the Greeks focused their oppression on were the following: Torah study, Shabbat observance, circumcision, Jewish family values, and the new month celebration. And what I'd like to do is just take a couple minutes to briefly examine each of these areas in order to better understand not only the Greek strategy, but what it was that the Maccabees' struggle ultimately was against, and therefore what we need to be vigilant about in our day and age. And it's fairly uncomplicated. Much like the day that the Lone Ranger and Tonto went camping into the desert. After they got their tent all set up, both men fell sound asleep. Some hours later, Tonto wakes the Lone Ranger and says, "Kimo sabe, look towards the sky. What do you see?" The Lone Ranger replies, "I see millions of stars." "What does that tell you?" asks Tonto. The Lone Ranger ponders for a minute and then says, "Astronomically speaking, it tells me there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, it tells me that Saturn is in Leo." And if you don't know what that means, that's okay. It's perfectly okay. "Time-wise," he continues, "it appears to be approximately 3:15 in the morning. Theologically, the Lord is all-powerful and we are small and insignificant. Meteorologically, got to say those things slowly, it seems we will have a beautiful day tomorrow. So, what does it tell you, Tonto?" "It tells me that you are dumber than buffalo dung. It means someone stole our tent." Sometimes we do have the tendency to make things more complicated than they really are. So, tonight I'm going to try to keep things somewhat simple and straightforward as we look at these five important things and what they mean. Remember, the first was Torah study. We would call it Chumash. We as a Jewish people are often known as people of the book. And the Torah has to do with our instructions for living. And it is the driving inspiration for our collective national wisdom. And it is that which, not just the inspiration for our national wisdom, but when others recognize what it is God has given to us, it becomes the reason they praise God. That's Deuteronomy 4, 5 to 8, very simply squashed together and condensed. Rabbi Emanuel Feldman wrote in a piece called On Judaism the following. Our history demonstrates that the moment study of Torah is neglected, we have classes this week, we will next semester, that have to do with Torah study. On board, and the commercial. Back to the quote. The moment Torah study is neglected, assimilation of the Jewish people into its surroundings makes its inroads. Without fail, every Jewish community in history that did not teach and study Torah as its first priority gradually disappeared from the scene. Beyond all the good rational reasons, Torah is the mysterious bridge which connects the Jew and God, the bridge across which they interact and communicate, and by means of which God fulfills his covenant with his people to sustain and protect them. It is therefore no surprise that Torah study is so central with us. It is the first blessing a newborn child receives. May they go up to Torah, to the wedding canopy, and to good deeds. No wonder Rabbi Akiva in the Talmud states that to expect a Jew to live without Torah is like expecting a fish to live without water, end quote. Given that understanding, no wonder the study of Torah is regarded as the most important of all of the some 613 instructions that God has given to us. And therefore, it's no wonder that the Greeks sought to stamp this out. Then we've got Shabbat observance. Each of us, as it turns out, has an ego which would prefer to have me, and by that I mean you as well, you know. You don't all prefer me to be at the center, but each of you as an individual prefers the individual you that is me, or the me that is you. All right, now we've got that thoroughly confused. Each of us has an ego that prefers to have our own me at the center of the universe, in control of my life, my destiny, and my world, that is part of Greek thought. Shabbat is the Jewish people's tool to counteract this very natural human tendency. And so once every 7 days, we as Jews and those who join with us relinquish control of our environment and make a statement to ourselves and to humanity that we are not in charge of this world. So we stop all creative work and acknowledge that it is God who runs the show. This is what the guideline or the instruction of not working on Shabbat accomplishes for us. We refrain from creative activity in order to regain clarity as to who the real Creator is. In this way, Shabbat is a wonderful tool to help us cultivate a real and relevant and very tangible relationship with God. And throughout the generations of our history, the key litmus test of whether an individual or family will remain a vibrant part of the Jewish people is their commitment to Shabbat. As the famous maxim says, I would have said that simpler famous saying, but as the famous saying says, it doesn't work too well. So as the famous maxim says, more than the Jew has kept the Shabbat has kept the Jew. And it is this key element of Jewish life that the Greeks were determined to obliterate. And then we've got circumcision. We call it Brit Milah or Milah. Well, it turns out that the Greeks believed that the human being was born complete and perfect. And this is why they glorified the human body with all the statues and athletic events. Jews, on the other hand, believe the world is in certain respects imperfect, and that we have been put on earth in order to partner with God and bring some improvement to the world. We call that Tikkun Olam, the repairing of the world. That is part of our national mission. And therefore, it's the responsibility of each and every Jew. As we know, one of the most important of the guidelines or instructions God has given to us in Judaism is circumcision. Remember, when God makes the eternal covenant with Abraham and his descendants, the symbol of that bond, that contract, is circumcision. In a sense, then, God is telling every Jew, the human form comes into this world with physical imperfection. And so, too, the world is imperfect. Just as we are called to, in a sense, perfect or modify the physical form through circumcision, so, too, God provides us with the tools and guidance to bring the world to a greater perfection as well. Now, the Greeks viewed the world as already perfect. And that explains why they outlawed circumcision. And then we have family values. We call it Nashim, Jewish family values. One of the evil Greek decrees was that every Jewish bride, before her wedding, was to spend one night with the Greek general. You see, the Greeks understood that the foundation of Jewish life is a sound and stable family. At the root of this stability is the family relationship. In fact, the sages of old, the rabbis of old, tell us that the bond between a husband and wife is analogous to the bond between humanity and God. That is why the values of the family are important. And it is this very concept the Greeks sought to uproot. And then we've got the new moon celebration, which can be called Yareach. Yareach. The final Greek decree prohibited Jewish people from celebrating the new moon. So why would they care about this aspect of Jewish observance, we should ask? Well, the answer is that the Jewish people follow a lunar calendar. And so we're compared to the cycles of the moon. By the way, the promises to David and the covenant God made with him is also compared to the cycles of the moon. Think about that with me for a moment. Just as the moon is full, but then wanes smaller, so too the Jewish people have suffered tremendous losses due to persecution or assimilation. Yet, as we know, the moon, once it reaches its lowest point of visibility, always becomes a new moon, and then begins waxing larger and larger till full size once again. It's almost as if the old line from the classic movie goes, wax on, wax off. Okay, somebody remember it. Never mind. Jewish history parallels the phases of the moon. Because one thing is certain, no matter how much it looks as if the Jewish people have disappeared, we always come back to strength thanks to God's covenant commitment to us. This idea is what the Greeks wanted to eliminate. They wanted to homogenize all people into the Greek culture, to see other cultures disappear. We refused to disappear. There is a concept, by the way, in Judaism, that God always provides the cure before the disease. I love it. Incredibly, in this case, the family name of Matatiyahu and Judah, Hasmonean, Hashmone in Hebrew, Het, Shin, Mem, Nun, Yod, specifically, that can be spelled out, Hashmone, can be spelled out as an acronym for the five evil Greek decrees. Het, Chumash, or Torah study. Shin, Shabbat observance. Mem, Milah, or Brit Milah. Nun, Nashim, Jewish family values. Yod, Yareach, celebration of new moon. In other words, hidden within the name itself is that the antidote, the Maccabees, was already in place before the disease was even spread. And they were alert to combat things that encroached on Jewish values in their lives and community. And like them, we too need to be vigilant, especially in our own circumstances and situations. The key to all this, it's found in the closing words of the Haftarah for this evening. Not by might, but by my spirit, says the Lord. We talked about that months ago when we were dealing with Rav Shaul's letter to Ephesus, chapter 5. We'll get back to that eventually. Verse 7 goes on to talk about the great mountain Zerubbabel. Interesting text. The rabbis of old considered that a picture of the Messiah. I want to elaborate on that just briefly, because I want to move on now. Look, we're well aware of the fact, and sometimes it becomes a little complicated, that often Hanukkah and Christmas overlap. And this is quite fitting for a number of reasons. As Dr. Patrice is fond of putting it, if there hadn't been a Hanukkah, there never would have been a Christmas. We've seen, 160 years before Yeshua's birth, the Syrian Empire, the Seleucids, we call them the Greeks, attempted to eliminate core Jewish practices, fighting for their values against the vastly superior Assyrian forces and overwhelming military odds. Judah and the Maccabees miraculously recaptured the temple and cleansed and rededicated it. Why are you repeating that, Rabbi? Because of the next statement. If God had not stepped in this way on behalf of the Maccabees, there would have been no Judea, no little town of Bethlehem, no Jewish Miriam and Joseph, and no little Jewish baby in the manger. And that reflection brings us to Hanukkah then. Hanukkah then? Well, you see, there is more to this story that we've been unfolding. A time of stories. 300 years earlier than the time of the Maccabees, as that very second temple of the Maccabees' focus was being built, after Israel had just returned from captivity in Babylon, the people were discouraged when they compared the new structure, when they compared that with the first temple that Solomon had built, the new one. Jewish history in a thumbnail. We've had two temples in Jewish history. Guess what the first one's called? First temple. Guess what the second was called? We're expecting another temple to be built. Guess what it will be called? Welcome to Jewish history. Where was I? Well, they looked at this second temple, the new one. It looked insignificant in comparison. So to encourage the people, God sent a striking message to Israel through Haggai and Malachi. Is it Malachi on Thursday? On Tuesday? More on the story of Malachi Tuesday night, 7:30. Be there. Anyhow, Haggai first told the people in the reading that you had tonight, I will shake all nations, listen, and the desired of all nations will come. And I will fill this house, talking about the temple, I will fill this house with glory, says the Lord Almighty. and the glory of this present house, again the temple, will be greater than the glory of the former house or temple. Now, the phrase desired of all nations has clear messianic overtones. And so Malachi adds, listen to the words he uses, then suddenly the Lord whom you seek will come. He will come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant whom you desire will come, says the Lord Almighty. Desired of all nations will come. Does that begin to sound familiar or similar? In light of these passages, it's striking that when the baby Yeshua first comes to that second temple that the Maccabees preserved, when he came there for the time of circumcision, Simon takes him and says, Luke chapter 2, my eyes have seen your salvation. Remember what the Hebrew for salvation is? Yeshua, right. My eyes have seen your salvation, a light for revelation to the Gentiles, and the glory for your people Israel. In other words, what he's saying is that God's promises to Israel through Haggai and Malachi had been fulfilled. The glory that came into the second temple now truly exceeded that of the first. But there's still more. The end of the Haggai portion talks about the events of his prophecy, and they are connected to a specific time. And the text says there, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from this day forward. So these events that he's talking about are connected with the 25th and following days of the ninth month. Now, the ninth month of the Jewish calendar that Haggai referred to is Kislev. So the events he predicts are set against the backdrop of Kislev the 25th and the days following. Look, as you know, Hanukkah begins on the 25th of Kislev. Strikingly, woven into the birth stories of Yeshua in three of the Gospels are themes and images of light. You've got the star that the Magi followed. You've got the glory of the Lord surrounding the angel's appearance to the shepherds. And then you've got the Word as the true light that gives light to everyone. Commercial. We talked about some of this just last night in the other class at the Seminary in Yeshiva. That's why you got to come to these things. Anyhow, that was a commercial in case you weren't listening. Now, the imagery of light forms a most appropriate setting for the birth of Messiah at Hanukkah, the festival of lights. And it was fitting then that Yeshua would be brought to the temple for his circumcision on the eighth day, just as the Hanukkah lights would be at their brightest, with all nine lights, because you've got a lighting candle. So anyhow, with all nine lights of the Hanukkah menorah being lit. No wonder Simon could say on seeing the baby Yeshua, my eyes have in fact seen a light for revelation to the Gentiles and the glory, as promised by Haggai, the glory of your people Israel. A little more than a century later, a gentleman by the name of Hippolytus, a leader in what is called the early church, would say, and I quote, the accepted date of Christ's birth is December 25, end quote. Now, given the use in the Roman Empire of a different calendar than the Jewish one, the adaptation of Kislev the 25th into December the 25th would have been quite natural. By the way, there's a remarkable passage found in a Jewish work called the Hanukkah Haggadah. It reads, and I quote, Hanukkah is the holiday that welcomes the Messiah. Peace is the Messiah. As the angels told the shepherds on the Judean hillside so many centuries ago regarding the birth of the Messiah, peace on earth. They knew what they were quoting. Goodwill toward all. And then a couple weeks after the shepherds arrived to worship the Messiah, the Jewish wise men came from the east. They came to give their allegiance to the newborn king and all he stood for. The same that the Maccabees stood for. And we need to do the same ourselves. And so may we be found, as the most appropriate Hanukkah card says, so may we be found rededicating our minds to hope, our hands to peace, and our hearts to love. Hanukkah then, and then, and now, now. It's your choice to respond. As the Maccabees, or not. Take the next minute or so in quiet reflection for that response.